From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor Joe Pantoliano. You probably know him from his role on the HBO series The Sopranos. He played Ralphie, a made man with no conscience. Pantoliano has also appeared in many films, including Risky Business, The Matrix, and Memento. His memoir about growing up in Hoboken, New Jersey, is just out in paperback, and Pantoliano's new series on CBS premieres later this month. It's called The Handler. Also, we'll talk with writer Jeffrey Eugenides. His latest novel is Middlesex. It won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction this year. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Once Upon a Time in the Midlands. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Labor Department says the jobless rate dropped a tenth of a percent in August to 6.1%, but economist Hugh Johnson of First Albany Corporation says a separate survey by the government shows the economy continues to lose jobs.
The bad news is, and it's very bad news, is that we saw the seventh successive decline in the number of jobs in the U.S. economy, a decline of 93,000. Most of us had been expecting, forecasting that we'd see an increase, maybe 25 to 40,000. So this was a very disappointing employment report and really confirms that we still have a recovery in the economy, but it's a jobless recovery.
Labor Secretary Elaine Chao says she's concerned about the job picture, but that there are growth sectors in the economy.
They include construction, healthcare, education, and financial services.
Chao says the administration wants to train or retrain workers for the growing job sectors. President Bush will deliver a primetime speech on Sunday night to address the nation on the subject of Iraq. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president will speak at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan says Mr. Bush will talk about the situation in Iraq in the context of the broader war on terrorism. The White House has always linked the toppling of Saddam Hussein to the fight against terrorism. It's possible the president will address topics he has publicly said nothing about this week, that is, his administration's decision to try to get greater United Nations involvement in Iraq, and reports that the rebuilding of the country could cost more than $60 billion. The speech is expected to last about 15 minutes. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Hurricane Fabian is snapping palm trees in Bermuda. At the Hurricane Center in Miami, meteorologist Chris Sisco says it's a Category 3 storm, the most violent to hit the island chain in 50 years.
It's battering Bermuda quite heavily at this time with winds in excess of 115 miles per hour. In addition, coastal storm tides of 6 to 10 feet have also been noted. We've been getting erratic reports of fairly heavy damage in Bermuda itself. And just recently, the Weather Service Office in Bermuda has lost most of their equipment, including their radar.
Meteorologist Chris Sisco in Miami. The National Weather Service has also issued flood warnings for five counties in central Florida as Tropical Storm Henri threatens the state's Gulf Coast with heavy rains. Forecasters say Henri could bring as much as a foot of rain to some areas where rivers and creeks are already full because of a rainy summer. In stocks today, the Dow lost 84 points to close at 9,503 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq was down 11 to 1,858. This is NPR News. The Nebraska Supreme Court has overturned the death sentence of a convicted murderer because he was sentenced by a panel of judges rather than a jury. The ruling comes just days after a federal appeals court threw out dozens of death sentences in three states for the same reason. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The ruling affects only the case of Raymond Matta Jr., who was convicted in 1999 for murdering the young son of a former girlfriend. At the time, a three-judge panel decided that the circumstances of the case warranted the death penalty. But last year, the U.S. Supreme Court said that only juries and not judges should hand down a death sentence. The High Court left unclear whether the ruling should be applied retroactively to inmates awaiting execution, like Matta. The Nebraska decision comes as no surprise. Earlier this week, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the death sentences of more than 100 prisoners in Arizona, Idaho, and Montana who had been sentenced by judges and not juries. Nebraska and Colorado, the only other states where judges can decide capital punishment cases, falls under a different appeals court, which has yet to rule on the issue. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
Two sons of a former Iraqi diplomat pleaded not guilty today to federal charges that they spied on Iraqi dissidents in the United States and passed the information to secret police in the regime of Saddam Hussein. Wissam Noman Alan Bouj entered his plea in a U.S. district court in Manhattan, along with his brother Raed Rokan Alan Bouj. The two men are sons of Iraq's former liaison with United Nations weapons inspectors. The indictments accuse the sons of giving the Saddam Hussein government information about Iraqi expatriates living in the United States. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 13, starring Holly Hunter and Evan Rachel Wood, co-written by a 13-year-old based on her own experience, now playing select theaters.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The last time we saw Joe Pantoliano on TV, he lost his head. More specifically, his character of loose cannon mobster Ralph Cifaretto, one of the best things about the HBO series The Sopranos last season, had been killed by James Gandolfini's Tony Soprano. Not just killed, but decapitated, with his head stuck in a bowling bag. Now Pantoliano is about to return to TV as the star of his own CBS series, The Handler. It's the best new series of the fall season, and this time, Pantoliano plays the good guy. He plays the head of a group of FBI undercover agents, and not only dispatches them, Mission Impossible style, but trains them.
We're going somewhere where we can talk.
Talk right here.
Look, you think you could just sell on my corner my customers because you want to?
I didn't see any sign that said that you own the street.
You weren't looking close enough.
You got a map in your car?
What?
Why don't you just show me what part of the city you don't own and I'll go sell over there?
Ready yet? Get in the car. I'll give you a ride and show you myself.
Why don't you just pump me some dope and I can stay where I am and we can both be happy. What?
No, you can't do that. No, that's entrapment. You gotta get him to make the suggestion. Let him come to you. But the attitude was good, I like that. You know how to push over and you didn't get in the car, that's important. And listen, what you did, getting sexy with me?
Yeah.
Don't do it unless you plan on going all the way with it.
If The Handler catches on, it'll be a nice payoff for a reliably entertaining actor who has appeared in more than 60 films, including Risky Business, The Fugitive, The Matrix, and Memento. He's also done great work for TV, including Frank Sinatra's role in a miniseries version of From Here to Eternity, and a pre-Sopranos role as a mob boss in a brilliant but short-lived CBS series, Easy Streets. Pantoliano also has written a memoir called Who's Sorry Now? About growing up in Hoboken in the 50s and early 60s. It's now out in paperback. His parents were on the fringes of crime. His stepfather was connected. Pantoliano spoke with Terry Gross last year.
Now, your new memoir, Who's Sorry Now, is about your coming of age. And although you're not from a mafia family and your family is nothing like The Sopranos, you weren't unfamiliar with crime when you were growing up, and neither was the rest of your family. Mm-hmm. Did they know about that? The people at The Sopranos, did they know about that when they asked you to be in the cast?
No, not at all. David Chase knew me from 1979, when I did From Here to Eternity, the remake of the novel, and I played Maggio, and he had seen me in that and was interested in putting me in a pilot that was kind of a spinoff when he was working on the Rockford Files. I didn't get the job, and I saw him infrequently over the years through a mutual friend, and then he called me, and I was available to come, and that's how it happened. But we there was never any kind of flushing out or interviews or tell me about who you, where you came from, background. He had, I don't think, to my knowledge, that he had even an idea that I was from New Jersey.
Now, tell us what your mother and father did for a living.
Well, Daddy worked at Standard Brands up until 1962 when he had a heart attack.
At Standard
Mommy,
Brands?
Standard Brands in Hoboken, New Jersey, which is now called the Lipton Tea Building. It's actually a high-rise apartments. And mom, she worked at her father's seamstress shop. She was a sewer, and she I remember we would do patches, that she would do piecework. They would cut the sergeant patches and corporal patches and into off of a whole sheet of material, and then she'd get X amount of cents for each piece that she cut. When we went down the shore, for a time she acted as a bookie, working for a local bookie in the area, and that way she could make $4 or $5 a week and enable us to stay down the shore for the summer. I worked for her. I was a runner. She would give me the receipts and the money, and I'd go down to the bakery on the way to the swimming pool and give them their money. And one of the reasons why I wanted to tell this story is in my culture, that is the culture of a New Jersey kid growing up, and I've started to see movies like The Godfather, or I read books like The Fortunate Pilgrim. The women, for me, were always in the background of these assertive, strong men. And my feeling was that the women in my life were much more assertive than the men. And the idea that, you know, Who's Sorry Now is taken from the song that my mother would sing, the Connie Francis song that my mother would sing when she would get the men in her life to blow their stack. She would needle them to the point where they would blow their stack. And I wrote a screenplay first based on my life called Just Like Mona. And the point that I was making in that, and I think I hope that that's the point, that it took me 45 years to realize that I am just like my mother, that the strengths that I have and the tenacity that I was born with or inherited was from her, not from the men in my life.
No, when she recruited you when you were a kid to run numbers for her, did you ever think to yourself, how could she do this to me? This is illegal. It's the kind of thing we could get busted for.
No, I mean, it was so simple. Take this down to the store. It was done ever so lightly. You know, with Cousin Flory, before he died, several years, he was older now, 75, 76, and starting to become frail from emphysema. You know, tobacco killed my entire family. My father from lung cancer, my mother from several strokes and a heart attack, and Flory from emphysema. But Flory one time was telling me that when he was a kid, at like 11 years old, he was delivering heroin, that his grandmother and father and uncle would cut heroin on their dining room table, and they would stiff cotton swabs in their nose as to not get the fumes from the heroin. And then little Flory, they put it in little brown vials, glass vials with a cork, and he would go down Mott Street and Hester Street and deliver it. And at that point, that wasn't illegal. In 1922, heroin and cocaine was still legal sale.
Well, you mentioned your cousin Flory. He was your mother's third cousin. And then later in life became your mother's lover and your mm-hmm. stepfather, or perhaps father. When you were, I don't know, about 12 maybe, your mother said to you, your yeah. father, he's not really your father. Cousin Flory is your father.
Yeah.
Was Cousin Flory really your father? Did you ever?
I don't think so. I think, although he was a father figure to me, somebody asked me this question recently and said, why haven't you ever done DNA to find out for sure? And the truth is that I was blessed with two fathers, and that this man, Florio, came into my life just at the right time when I was just about to fall off the edge of the table. And he was there to catch me, and he saw in me innocence and a future that was robbed from him. He was born into a lifestyle that he never had a chance.
He did a lot of time in a federal penitentiary.
He spent combined time, over 21 years of his life, he spent inside federal penitentiary. So you know, he got out of the life at 51 years old. And so he spent the last 27 years of his life outside of prison working as a working stiff, driving a truck, whatever it took to provide for the family that he chose.
What did he do to land him in the pen?
Well, the last one was heroin trafficking, but he did a variety of things, counterfeiting, hijacking. You know, I, in doing the research for doing the book, I tried to find his papers. I called the FBI and tried to get his rap sheet, but it's gotten too far back. It's too old.
So here's this guy who was, you know, selling heroin and hijacking trucks, et cetera, et cetera. And he's the guy who prevented you from falling off the edge. What did he do for you? What was going wrong in your life, and how did he help you?
Well, you know, when mommy said that Flory, cousin Flory, was my real dad, I think she did that to protect herself because she was riddled with guilt about taking Flory over daddy. And she was afraid, looking back now, that she was afraid that I was going to take daddy's side. And it was really important for her to be the victim of this. When I talked to my cousin Antoinette, and I reflect on that in the end of the book, when Antoinette said several days before mommy died or weeks, she said that she was wrong for doing what she did to Monk.
And Monk's the name of your father.
Yeah, my father was Monk, Dominic Monk Pantoliano. But Flory really loved me, and he really wanted the best for me, to the point where he threatened me if I did something wrong, that there would be serious repercussions, and I believed him.
And you hadn't had that before. You hadn't anybody who cared enough.
I never had. By that point, teachers had written me off. My parents were afraid. You see, my mommy and daddy were afraid to go out and reach out and grab at the gold coin. They wanted the best for me, but they didn't want me to be so ambitious because they felt that I'd be hurt. Who was I to think that I was entitled to be an actor? You know, that wasn't there for us or our kind. And I think a lot of my family members felt that way and frightened. Mommy didn't want me, you know, what were people going to say, that I was going to move to New York as a single male at 19 years old? I mean, and they were also really superstitious about all of that stuff. So Flory kept saying, don't worry about it. Do this. You got to do this. Go. He found an actor, and he introduced me to him, and they took me down to HB Studios, and I met Herbert Berghoff, and I was still in high school when I started studying acting.
Actor Joe Pantoliano speaking with Terry Gross last year. We'll hear more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Joe Pantoliano. His memoir, Who's Sorry Now, is out in paperback. And this fall, he stars as an undercover agent in the new CBS series, The Handler.
How connected was your cousin Flory, or your stepfather Flory?
Well, Flory was never made. He was never indoctrinated into the organization known as Cosa Nostra. But he was Bilodino Murano, who I talk about in the book, was my great uncle. He was a descendant of the Genovese family. Mommy and Uncle Pete used to run the Italian lottery. That's what Grandpa Gus, Dopey Gus, my grandfather, he organized that, and that was veto sanctioned. So Uncle Pete and Mommy would have to take the money from the Italian lottery to Vito when Vito was a young man. So they all loved Vito. And Vito was a part of their lives. He would go down the shore with them. And Flory was being groomed to be in that. Joe King was a mentor of Florio's. And I remember meeting Joe King when Flory came home from prison. And Flory loved him like a father. Flory also had a father that Joseph Isabella, who had become a user of the same poison that he was selling on the street, heroin. And he died a junkie. So Flory had really strong issues about the use of it. And he, you know, I didn't. As a young adult, I was totally conflicted by what he had done. Mm-hmm. But I would never have the courage to confront him on it.
Because your stepfather, Flory, was pretty connected, although he wasn't a made man, and you knew that he'd spend time in the pen, you knew he did a lot of crimes, were you in awe of his status in the crime world, or was that an embarrassment for you? I mean, how did you feel about that?
It had serious cachet in the neighborhood to have a guy who was a known wise guy from New York. I mean, the New York City, it was a big deal. People would whisper, and the kids in the neighborhood treated you with respect. It was like having an athlete or a movie star staying over your house.
How much did you want to know about what he'd really done?
Nothing. He'd never brought it home. We didn't know. He was in it very shortly. You know, in the book, I describe when they got arrested, Mommy, my sister Marianne, and Flory, that Sunday afternoon. And it was at that point where we had moved out of the projects. We had moved off of welfare. We were living in Fort Lee. He had spent $10,000 in cash on furnishing this new apartment. And he was waiting to work a deal with his cousins who were in the gas station business, that he wanted to get that money. He had $40,000 in cash in 64 or 65. That was a lot of money. And while he was waiting to start a life with that money, he lost it all at the track. You'd go to the Big A every day, and within 4 or 5 months, we were broke again. We were back in the same situation, this time with a lot of fancy furniture.
Well, you know, you say in your book that because you were a fat kid and on the short side, you were a real target for abuse from the other kids. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you would, like, entertain them, and that would prevent them from beating you up. But sometimes when you got beaten up, your mother would insist on you telling her who was responsible for it, and she'd go after them, which was really embarrassing for you.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't insist. She just took over. You know, it's kind of hard to come home when your shirt's all torn up and your nose is bleeding and you got a big black eye, and she's going, "What happened?" "Nothing. Don't tell me you're not nothing. You're some of a bitch. Get over here." And she'd grab one of my friends and put him up against the wall, like, you know, James Cagney. "Tell me who did this," right? And then she'd go down and with a stick, you know, the broomstick, and just whack the hell out of the kid.
Was it embarrassing or what?
It was horrifying. It was humiliating. And, you know, she was like a battle axe. She was this big steam engine. She wasn't afraid of anybody.
Now, in your memoir, you describe how your mother fought with your father all the time. Lots of four-letter words when they were fighting. No one was going to think about protecting you from from that language. And then when your mother lived with your stepfather, again, lots of big fights. Did you have any sense that two people could live together and actually get along without fighting all the time?
No. In fact, I mean, after 15 years of therapy, I didn't want to be attached to a girl. I mean, during high school, I never had a girlfriend. And I didn't go to the prom when I graduated. And the only reason why I graduated high school was I thought that I'd be around my mother less that way. At least I'd have to deal with her until 3:30 or 4 in the afternoon. And that's, in fact, by then, I started working when I was 12 years old. I worked at my uncle's gas station, and I worked at the AMP. And then when I moved to New York, I was a waiter, and I always had a job. But I thought that all women were like my mother, and that I would expect them to turn into that. I'm still waiting for my wife to turn into my mother. I got one of the sweetest, kindest wives, my wife Nancy. We've been together 13 years. When I married her, I thought, well, now that we're married, she's going to turn into my mother. I'm waiting. You know, I'm still waiting for the other shoe to fall. And she hasn't yet.
Uh-huh.
And I'm surrounded by women, Terry. Everyone. I have three daughters, a nanny. I have my wife, Nancy. The cats are female. And the only male is Abbott, my dog, and me. And we've both been neutered. My wife had me fixed 2 years ago, and Abbott was fixed 8 years ago.
Now, when you were growing up, school was really hard. You didn't do very well in school. And you had an undiagnosed case of dyslexia, which was diagnosed later. So that explains why reading was so difficult. When did you end up getting it diagnosed?
Well, I never got it diagnosed. It was just assumed that it was dyslexia because of the way I was spelling things and the fact that I presently, when I was 18 years old, see, I'd been left back three times. When I was a kid in the Hoboken school system, there were 6 months graduating terms, like 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B. When I was in the third grade, I was in 3A, and then they said, well, we're going to just combine it to yearly graduations going on to the next class. So then I got skipped 6 months. So by then, I was really screwed up. I was already behind in the 3A part, right? I should have been in 2B. But it got to be such, I was so riddled with anxiety, I started getting boils. And then by the time I reached high school, I was almost 19 because I'm born in September. So when I graduated my senior year, it was in June. I was going to be 19 in September. And it was in the middle of the year, in February, I think it was, when I did the high school play. And never had a need for reading. You know, I watched television all the time. So I didn't really have a need for reading. I watched the nightly news, and I got my information from that. And it got to a point where I realized that this reading thing was something my teacher, Miss Damiano, Mr. Fredericks, they said, look, you have an aptitude for this acting thing. This is something that you could work at and maybe be successful at. But if that's the case, you're going to need to learn how to read. So I read my first book my senior year in high school, and he gave me, I was at gym class, and Mr. Fredericks came and gave me Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver.
That was your first book?
Yeah, he thought I'd, and I, it took me 3 weeks, 4 weeks to read it.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I mean, after that, the next book I read was The Valachi Papers, then was The Godfather. You know, things that I could relate to, relatable things.
Uh-huh. So then was reading a problem for you when you started acting seriously, or were you good enough by then that you could?
No, it took 7 years. It took a long time to, I would have to prepare for an audition. I'd have to put 2 or 3 hours into each audition. And then I would go in, it was like double acting. I would go in and pretend that I was reading off the page when in fact I had memorized it.
Actor Joe Pantoliano. We'll hear more of his interview in the second half of the show. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Sorry now. Sorry now. Sad and blue, who's crying too, just like I cry over you. Right to the end, just like a friend.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of My Losing Season, a memoir of life, love, and basketball by Pat Conroy, author of The Prince of Tides. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with actor Joe Pantoliano. He's got a new series on CBS this fall. It's called The Handler. He plays an FBI agent. Also, a talk with writer Jeffrey Eugenides. He just won the Pulitzer Prize for his book Middlesex. And a review of the British film Once Upon a Time in the Midlands. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley. Let's return to our interview with actor Joe Pantoliano, recorded last year. He starred in The Sopranos as Ralphie until he was decapitated for his evil deeds. This fall, he returns to TV in a new series, The Handler, as a good guy, an undercover agent. When Pantoliano spoke to Terry, he had just published his memoir about growing up in Hoboken in the 50s and 60s. It's now out in paperback.
No, I think your real breakthrough film part was in Risky Business, which was also the movie that launched Tom Cruise's career. And in this movie, Tom Cruise plays a high school kid whose parents are leaving him alone in their big suburban home for a few days while they're out of town. And then he befriends a woman who he doesn't realize is a prostitute who's had a fight with her pimp. She and her girlfriend, who's also a prostitute, are staying at Tom Cruise's house when you, Guido the pimp, shows up to take these two girls home. Let me play a clip from that scene.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
Joe, the door is locked. He's starting to give me a stomachache.
Good. I hope it hurts.
So open the door or what?
We don't go home. We don't need you anymore.
Look, shut your mouth.
No. Listen, well, maybe we don't work for you anymore.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Right.
Then who you work for, huh? Who? You don't work for me.
Who? You don't work for me.
Maybe we work for Joel now.
She's only kidding. I hope so. Look, Joel, you look like a smart kid. So I'm going to tell you something which I'm sure you'll understand. Now, you're having fun now, right? Right, Joel? Time of your life? Be as slug as you can and never, ever f*** with another man's livelihood. Now, if you're smart, like I hope you are, you're not going to make me come back here.
Joe Pantoliano and Tom Cruise in a scene from Risky Business. What's the biggest leap that you took in changing your look for a film, your look or your manner?
Oh, gosh. I did a Western called El Diablo, and I played a Truman Capote-type writer of Western novellas, and that was really fun. I mean, I was imitating Katharine Hepburn, and I talked like this, and I was with Anthony Edwards and Lou Gossett Jr., and I had a really, really wonderful time working on it.
That's great. So what's it like now when you're given a new script? Can you read it pretty well?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that I'm probably... it takes me a couple hours. I would say it takes me a minute. No, it takes me about a half a minute a page, depending on how much dialogue. But I read a lot now. I enjoy reading, and that was the greatest thing, is the world of books. I collect first editions now. I have a modest collection.
Uh-huh.
But
of what?
Modern day 20th century authors.
Huh. Interesting. So how has being a movie star changed your standing in the old neighborhood? Do you know anybody else there? Have they all been driven out by gentrification?
See, I don't look at myself as a movie star. I always thought that a movie star is somebody that makes, you know, $5 million, $2 million, $1 million a movie. People see me, and because I'm a personality and that I'm someone that's recognized, they think that I've lived this gorgeous life and I'm driving Maseratis and living in a palace. And I'm here to tell you, Joey Pants doesn't own a palace. I'm just a working actor, and my friends and my family are proud of me. One of the nicest things that was said to me yesterday is my friend Joey Fiano, who I talk about in the book, who's lost his father, and a week later he lost his mother, and at 18 years old raised his siblings. And he called me up yesterday. I hadn't talked to him in 10 years, and he said to me, "I'm going to go get the book," and he says, "Joey, you got to live all of your dreams. All of your dreams came true." And they have, you know? And now I get to tell this story. So whether nobody reads the book, this is something my kids could read someday. And it's a document of where they came from. I think that's great.
It sounds like your book really was like therapy for you. Have you actually been in therapy?
Yeah, I was in therapy for 15 years. Oh, God.
did you understand the role that, for instance, your mother had played in your life and how overbearing she was in your life and what impact that had on
you? Well, I'll tell you how I got into therapy.
Yeah, go ahead.
We were working at O'Neill's Balloon. I was a waiter, and Florrie was the manager.
That's a restaurant right near Lincoln Center in Manhattan.
That's right. It's not there anymore, but it's owned by Patrick O'Neill, an actor. And here I am now, an actor who owns a restaurant. I have a restaurant in South Norwalk called Bamboo, Connecticut. My sister Marianne quit school at 15, and she was beside herself, my mother. And I was going to acting school with John Lennon, and one of the kids was taking this group therapy thing. So I said, Ma, there's this guy, he's a group therapy thing. Maybe you should take Marianne and talk to him. Maybe he can help her out. So she did, and they were going to come and meet us at O'Neill's Balloon. Well, my mother was fit to be tied, and I said, what's the matter? She goes, this no-good SOB says that your sister's problems are my fault. And I just went like, somebody said this to her? And the next day I called the guy up, and I go, I got to meet you, because if you're telling my mother that it's her, that she's the reason we're so screwed up, I have to meet you. And that's how I started the group therapy.
One last thing. When did you first start being called Joey Pants?
The kids called me Joey Pants, and it was always because people couldn't say the name.
Even in an Italian neighborhood?
They call you Pantliana, Pantleone, Pumpliana. I mean, they murdered the English language in that town. And so they would call me Pants. They'd say Pants because, you know, pantalone means pants in Italian.
Right. Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
I had a ball.
Actor Joe Pantoliano. His memoir about growing up in Hoboken is now out in paperback, and his new TV series, The Handler, premieres on CBS later this month. Coming up, author Jeffrey Eugenides. This is Fresh Air. You may know Jeffrey Eugenides as the author of the novel The Virgin Suicides, which was adapted into a film. He won the Pulitzer Prize this year for his second novel, Middlesex. It's now out in paperback. The narrator of the story was born in 1960 and starts life as a girl named Callie. But as she approaches puberty, she realizes she isn't like other girls. Eventually, she discovers she was born a hermaphrodite and is becoming more physically masculine with age. In her early teens, she abandons her identity as a woman, changes her name from Callie to Cal, and begins to live as a man. The story also covers the two preceding generations of the narrator's family, starting with his Greek immigrant grandparents. When the book was released last year, the New York Times said, "The novel turns the story of Cal's coming of age into an uproarious epic, at once funny and sad, about misplaced identities and family secrets." Eugenides has delivered a deeply affecting portrait of one family's tumultuous engagement with the American 20th century. Terry spoke with Jeffrey Eugenides last year. Let's start with the author reading a passage from Middlesex.
I was born twice. First as a baby girl on a remarkably smogless Detroit day in January of 1960, and then again as a teenage boy in an emergency room near Petoskey, Michigan in August of 1974. Specialized readers may have come across me in Dr. Peter Luce's study Gender Identity and 5 Alpha Reductase Pseudohermaphrodites, published in the Journal of Pediatric Endocrinology in 1975. Or maybe you've seen my photograph in Chapter 16 of the now sadly outdated Genetics and Heredity. That's me on page 578, standing naked beside a height chart with a black box covering my eyes. My birth certificate lists my name as Calliope Helen Stefanides. My most recent driver's license from the Federal Republic of Germany records my first name simply as Cal. I'm a former field hockey goalie, long-standing member of the Save the Manatee Foundation, rare attendant at the Greek Orthodox liturgy, and, for most of my adult life, an employee of the U.S. State Department. Like Tiresias, I was first one thing, and then the other. I've been ridiculed by classmates, guinea-pigged by doctors, palpated by specialists, and researched by the March of Dimes. A red-headed girl from Grosse Pointe fell in love with me, not knowing what I was. Her brother liked me, too. An army tank led me into urban battle once. A swimming pool turned me into myth. I've left my body in order to occupy others. And all this happened before I turned 16.
That's Jeffrey Eugenides reading the beginning of his new novel, Middlesex. Jeffrey, why did you want to write about a contemporary hermaphrodite?
Well, the first kernel of the idea came to me when I read an actual memoir of a 19th century hermaphrodite that Michel Foucault found in the archives of the French Public Department of Hygiene. And I thought this would be a very interesting book, and went and read it and was filled with frustration because the hermaphrodite in question, Herculine Barbin, was a convent school girl, or at least in her early years. And when she came to write the story of her life, she wrote very much like a convent school girl. I actually brought the diary with me in case you wanted to hear some of it. But
oh, yeah, you bet. Why don't you read a few lines from it?
I will. This is midway through her memoirs when she has fallen in love with her best friend at the convent school, and this is the first night they spend together. Happy about this pretext, which was only too true, one evening I asked my friend to share my bed. She accepted with pleasure. It would be impossible to express the happiness I felt from her presence at my side. I was wild with joy. We talked for a long time before going to sleep, I with my arms encircling her waist, she with her face resting near my own. My God, was I guilty? And must I accuse myself here of a crime? No, no. That fault was not mine. It was the fault of an unexampled fatality, which I could not resist. 3! Henceforth, Sarah belonged to me. 2! She was mine. 3! It sort of goes on in that fashion. And I was just terribly frustrated because she was evasive about her story, and all of the things I wanted to know about a hermaphrodite's life, she was unable to tell me. And I got the idea of writing my own story, and in contrast with the way most hermaphrodites in literature have been handled, usually as mythical creatures or as fanciful creations like Orlando and Virginia Woolf, I wanted to write a story about a real-life hermaphrodite and be accurate as possible as I could about the medical facts and the biological circumstances.
What's the medical explanation for your main character's condition?
Well, it's a very rare genetic mutation, and the condition is called 5-alpha reductase deficiency syndrome. And it occurs in very isolated communities. What it basically is, if you inherit this mutation, your body is unable to respond to certain androgens or male hormones for a long time. So as you're formed in the womb, you would have an XY chromosome, you would be male, and you would be born looking very, very much like a girl, almost undetectably so. And at puberty, as testosterone gets stronger in your blood, you would then virilize and become quite masculine in appearance. So it's one of the most dramatic hermaphroditic conditions that exists, and that's one of the reasons it appealed to me. But in that it was usually occurring only in inbred communities and isolated communities, I then saw a chance to make this story, broaden this story from a fictional memoir of a hermaphrodite to a story about an entire family, a Greek-American family in this case, and the transmission of this gene down through the generations until it finally is inherited by the narrator and flowers in her body, and later as a man she tells the story.
And since this genetic condition happens in inbred populations, you have this character's grandparents being not only husband and wife, but also brother and sister. And the character's parents are not only husband and wife, but also second cousins. Why did you want to explore that kind of familial, marital relationship?
Well, the inbreeding was demanded by the genetic condition I was using. And to bring in mythology again, of course, Zeus and Hera, I believe, are brother and sister. in Greek mythology, and so I was playing with some of these ideas, ancient ideas in literature. I needed to dramatize inbreeding, and inbreeding is actually quite boring. It takes generations and generations and centuries, and so in order to dramatize that, it required me to speed up the process and to actually have the grandparents be siblings. It seemed to me to be the best way to dramatize, you know, what was going on at a cellular level.
Now, in the beginning of your book, Middlesex, the narrator explains that he was born as a girl and reborn as a teenage boy in an emergency room at the age of 14. What happens in the emergency room?
Well, in the emergency room is the first time when someone other than Callie sees her anatomy in bright light. At that point, Callie is 14. She still looks like a girl, though a flat-chested one. But after an accident, she's taken to the emergency room, and in undressing her to see if she has any broken bones, the doctor does see her genitals, which at that point would be not characteristic or entirely characteristic of a girl of her age.
And why does your character decide to be a boy?
Well, it's a long process and a difficult one for her. The condition that she has, of course, is so virilizing that after she goes through puberty, she would basically have musculature, facial hair, and a deep voice, and would appear to be male. So it would be easier at least to operate in society as a male. And Kel, as he talks about his life in Berlin as an adult, he's careful to say that he operates in society as a male. It's not clear whether he considers himself a regular man or a regular guy, but it is the way that he most easily can get along.
He seems to have a consciousness of what he is, which is something that's strictly neither 100% male nor 100% female.
Right. But I think in terms of the book itself, because Callie falls in love with her best friend, that did provide a certain impetus for her decision to be a boy. But then, of course, when she goes to the gender identity clinic, she does find out about her chromosomal status being XY, and that is another reason why she finally decides to adopt a male gender identity.
When she decides to adopt a male gender identity, she has to learn the outward characteristics of men. I want you to read a paragraph. This is on page 449, in which your main character describes that kind of transformation of learning to walk and talk like a male.
Like a convert to a new religion, I overdid it at first. Somewhere near Gary, Indiana, I adopted a swagger. I rarely smiled. My expression throughout Illinois was the Clint Eastwood squint. It was all bluff, but so was it on most men. We were all walking around squinting at each other. My swagger wasn't that different from what lots of adolescent boys put on, trying to be manly. For that reason, it was convincing. Its very falseness made it credible. Now and then I fell out of character. Feeling something stuck to the bottom of my shoe, I kicked up my heel and looked back over my shoulder to see what it was, rather than crossing my leg in front of me and twisting up my shoe. I picked correct change from my open palm instead of my trouser pocket. Such slips made me panic, but needlessly. No one noticed. I was aided by that. As a rule, people don't notice much.
I'm wondering if when you wrote that, you thought back to your own puberty and when you were going through the process of turning into a man from having been a boy, and if you felt that you were acting in a way, acting the role of man.
This continues to be something that I feel like I do. I, in order to get those characteristics that I thought were more common amongst females than males, I didn't think back to my early years. I actually walked around my room trying to imagine how do girls usually look at things when they're stuck to their shoe? How do they count change? And it actually took me a long time to come up with just those few examples that seemed to me evidently female or male.
Well, Jeffrey Eugenides, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Jeffrey Eugenides, speaking with Terry Gross last year. He won the Pulitzer Prize this year for his novel Middlesex. Coming up, a review of the British film Once Upon a Time in the Midlands. This is Fresh Air. The young director Shane Meadows sets his low-budget films in the dried-up mining towns of the British Midlands, where he grew up. His latest, Once Upon a Time in the Midlands, has gotten critical attention here. But film critic David Edelstein says the film's great performances aren't enough to carry the film.
The joke of the British comedy Once Upon a Time in the Midlands is the way it gives middle-class life a whiff of a Sergio Leone epic western. Bingo parlors and dumpy pubs become, in a single composition, Wild West saloons. There are brawls over barca loungers, and the music is suddenly twangy, with a lone harmonica and clip-clops. It's fun to see middle-class life on screen, even when it doesn't measure up to our movie myths and turns into a clown show. The sheer novelty of the middle-class milieu on screen can be elating. That might be why the film has gotten rave reviews, when it's actually kind of middling. It's directed by Shane Meadows, whose last two films, 24/7, with Bob Hoskins, and A Room for Romeo Brass, had a semi-documentary style and were low on whimsy. Once Upon a Time in the Midlands is Whimsy City. Its cuteness softens every edge. Meadows' other movies were plainly influenced by his countryman Mike Leigh, but this one comes at middle-class life from the opposite direction. In a Leigh film, the faceless housing developments and identical townhouses grind a person's individuality down. Here, Meadows wants to show that inside those samey houses and uniforms are people styling themselves in hilariously different ways, like the overweight, underemployed chap in the 10-gallon cowboy hat, or the three central characters, played by actors who transcend the movie's predictability through sheer weirdness. First, we meet Shirley, played by Shirley Henderson, who has been corralled to appear on a nationally televised talk show to comment on the strange estrangement of her sister-in-law, Carol, who loves her husband, Charlie, but won't let him live with the family. It's a ruse, though. Shirley's boyfriend, Deck, played by Reese Ifans, shows up to propose marriage on the air, whereupon Shirley gets flustered and says she can't marry him. And far away in Glasgow, her ex-husband, a criminal called Jimmy, played by Robert Carlyle, watches the show and decides to come back to town to reclaim his woman. In this scene, Deck engages in epic self-pity the morning after their nationally televised fiasco.
I know what you're doing, talking about me.
Can we talk, please?
I can't now, Shirley. I'm late for work.
Don't go off like this, eh?
I can't fake it, Shirley. You've wounded me. See, I'm a laughing stock, aren't I?
No, you're not.
Yes, I am, Shirley. Yes, I am.
Come and sit down with me.
Sit down? Sit down in my own house and be laughed at? No way, Shirley. I'm going to work now. At least there I'm going to get a little bit of respect. Have a nice day.
You can hear in that scene the limitations and the charm of the material. On one hand, it's sitcom grandstanding. On the other, Ifans grandstands gloriously. You might remember him and laugh remembering as Hugh Grant's skinny Welsh flatmate in Notting Hill. And if you're lucky, you saw him as a jungle boy turned aristocrat in Charlie Kaufman's Human Nature. Here he's put on weight, and he looks helpless and befuddled in that big new body. He's like a Welsh Fred Gwynne, which isn't a slight, because Gwynne was a great clown. And that voice of Shirley Henderson's, it's magic. She was unforgettable as the junkie soprano in Mike Leigh's Topsy Turvy, and she had small parts in Bridget Jones's Diary and as the ghost in The Girl's Loo in the last Harry Potter movie. And here, she's a dark, squirmy, twittery little thing, a warm-blooded sparrow. As the outlaw ex-husband, who marches through the non-swinging pub door to get her back, Robert Carlyle gives one of his riotously contained performances. This wiry little guy just stands there smoldering in his leather jacket and ponytail and looks like he could rip the head off Arnold Schwarzenegger. I couldn't understand half the dialogue, but I didn't care, because the sounds coming out of the actors' mouths were so funny and expressive. And I love that the violence, just fisticuffs, is shot from a distance to make it look clumsy and idiotic. But the structure of the movie is a mess. The sister-in-law subplot has no follow-through, and it gets more and more humdrum as it goes along. The final showdown between Deck and Jimmy, which should be crazy and scaled big, why else invoke Sergio Leone, is cozy Lifetime TV movie stuff. What happened? I think Meadows tried to find a compromise between his edgy documentary instincts and his desire for a lovable art house U.S. hit. So you could call this movie Once Upon a Time in the Middle of the Road.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculi.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, late-night talk show host Conan O'Brien. He celebrates 10 years on the air next week with a primetime special. Join us for the next Fresh Air.